This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
Look, Bumble knows you're exhausted by dating. All the, must not take yourself too seriously, and 6-1 since that matters, and what do I even say other than, hey? Well, that's why they're introducing an all-new Bumble, with exciting features to make compatibility easier, starting the chat better, and dating safer. They've changed, so you don't have to. Download the new Bumble now.
Families have a lot going on. Let Ollie help manage the mental load with new cognitive health supplements for everyone 4 and up, like delicious Ollie Focus Pops or Ollie Mellow Pops for kids. And for parents, try 3 new Brainy Chews to help you focus, chill out, or get energized. Find these cognitive health buddies for the whole fam at Ollie.com. That's OLLY.com. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast, a channel here on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran. More importantly, today I have the pleasure of speaking with Dr. Diana Dimitrova. We'll be speaking on a brand new 2021 Routledge publication that she's edited, fascinating publication called Rethinking the Body in South Asian Traditions. Diana, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me.
So rethinking the body in South Asian traditions, you know, the first question that comes to mind is, well, why do we need to rethink the body? What is this all about? And maybe tie in the backstory. How did this volume come about?
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you. The thing is that the body is so complex as a topic and so pervasive, and it basically alludes and informs every aspect of our lives. If you think, you know, not in terms of South Asia, South Asian studies, but everything we do, it has been at the center of every aspect of our lives. And rethinking the body, because there have been several important publications on this issue, but I think what has been maybe in a way missing or lacking is having the tradition talk for itself. Like in our volume, it's colleagues, scholars who work with South Asian languages, who have firsthand access to the material in different, in Sanskrit, in Hindi, in other languages, and who use a variety of theoretical approaches to basically let the tradition talk by analyzing texts published in South Asian languages. I think this was like a much needed publication over the past years.
That's a really fascinating, salient, important point. Allowing tradition to speak for itself. You or I may know immediately or have some idea of what you mean by that. But for a more general audience, the podcast is an interesting mix, right? Our colleagues listen in. Of course, it's people fascinated with all things Indic, maybe those from Hindu homes, maybe not, maybe continuing studies learners. So what do you mean by having tradition speak for itself? And maybe talk a little bit about the intervention or sort of the history of scholarship in this area. Like, what do you mean by that?
As we know, there has been a scholarship in India forever, right? That's Sanskrit scholarship, Sanskrit aesthetics and poetics. Then, you know, the encounter with the West, the interest toward India coming from Western scholars, the emergence of Orientalism that has done as much good as maybe bad, you know, then the need for post-colonial studies, but also the critique, you know, toward post-colonial studies that sometimes, you know, people use the victimization, poverty of people just to promote their own agendas and so forth. So where really the voices of all these people who we study. And now recently there's been a drive for a so-called decolonial approach where we study traditions in order also to empower people, to let the voices of people being heard. And I think in order to do that, we need to work with South Asian languages, we need to study the communities firsthand, and we need to let people and traditions speak. So I think this is what is amazing about this book, that even though it offers a sustained textual and in some cases anthropological study of the question, it also deals with texts written in South Asian languages, which modern languages, which is of course very important nowadays.
Tell us how this volume came into being. Is this a result of an email chain, a conference, a pub night? Like, how did this come into being?
I've been thinking about this volume for many years. Basically, it's a product not of one single conference, but of many multiple conferences and exchanges with colleagues. I just found out at some point that no matter what the topic of the conference or the panel is, we've been talking about the body without really identifying it as a topic per se. So this made me think, let's really look at this more closely, and let's think of a book, you know, that will both incorporate current scholarship on the body and would also present something beyond that. Yeah, something that would also discuss the dichotomy of body and mind, and how the body has been used, you know, to legitimate the power to other communities, to reinforce power structures. And there, you know, it came the idea of this book, and I had all these enthusiastic colleagues, you know, who were on board. I don't want to take any credit for this book because it's an edited volume. And there are seven chapters in this volume, like colleagues who look at different perspectives, who study the issue in an in-depth way, but also based on their own research. So it is they who should have the credit for the book, basically, not me.
What Diana means to say is that she deserves 1/7 of the credit because one of the contributions is her. I'm teasing. And surely there's a great deal of labor that goes into the work behind the scenes to bring something like this together. But what, maybe we should dive into some of the papers. That'll give us a better basis for conversation. So in the first paper by Chris Austin, what is the gist of it?
Well, Chris Austin, he studies a Sanskrit text and he's looking, he focuses on the Harivamsa, or the lineage of the Lord, which is a text from the second or third century CE. And he says that it constitutes the oldest retelling of the god Krishna's life. And he argues that this important text established the divine and genealogical identity of Krishna as a form of Vishnu and as a Vrishni warrior. And he discusses not only the apparent issues of patriline and male descent, but also the implied and not so obvious concerns about the failure of patriline in the narratives of Krishna's life.
Yeah, this the volume I found fascinating, but selfishly, Chris Austin's article caught my eye because I also study Puranas. We've also had him on the podcast, but they're all fascinating. But it's a rich look at the patriline for sure. What would you say is the main takeaway what Chris is doing? Like, why is he looking at this?
Well, I think by using the notion of the body as a tool for interpretation, he has traced the ritual and mythological anxieties over patriline and the male body to the earlier Vedic period. And he suggests that the recurring images of corporeal seizure and restriction in the accounts of Krishna and his male offspring are of similar nature to those earlier concerns. And he argues that Krishna's lineage itself can be seen as a male body, which is threatened and restored together with its individual members of the narratives of Harivamsa. So I think it's a very interesting approach, like innovative and kind of, it's a fresh reading of the classic text,
Indeed, and this idea that the lineage itself is an embodying this sort of play on the very corporeal world as, you know, an embodied state, you know, this reminds me of the very beginning of the Markandeya Purana. It's so interesting. You have this Purana by mouthed by Markandeya, and how it starts off is Jaimini, a student of Vyasa, comes to Markandeya to ask Markandeya about the Mahabharata. Can you imagine? He's a student of Vyasa who wrote the Mahabharata.
Yeah.
And he's saying, you know, I have these puzzling questions. He's going to Markandeya because Vyasa can't answer his questions, apparently. And his very first question is, you know, why does Vishnu take on a body again? Like, what's up with this avatara? So this is obviously a very important theme in Puranic lore. Enough about me and my Puranic fetish. What's the next paper?
Yeah, the next paper actually is by our colleague Monius, who unfortunately died last year, and this may have also been maybe her last publication. I had the task also to do some editing in terms of text or whatever, although she was not there anymore, you know, to consult with her. So I was very emotional about that, and I did everything possible just to resist all the invitations, you know, by the publisher to do any types of editing of the text, just because I did not think it's ethical. Finally I found a way to kind of do this by just indicating in the footnotes that this has been the making of the editor, not of the author, and all that. It's a wonderful paper which deals with the role of bodies in the work of the 7th century Tamil Shaiva poet Saint Tirunavakachar, more affectionately known by Tamil speaking devotees as Appar or Father. It's a very well-known figure, and it has also been known that this poet figure have loaded his own body. And Anne Monius argues that Appar's poetic oeuvre is remarkable for its particular attention to those unfortunate characteristics of the human body, which account for its being always distracted by the senses and which have doomed it to perish. So, and she holds that a close examination of the poetic work attributed to Appar revealed complex ideas of human and divine bodies. And she concludes that Appar's poems invite their audiences not to ignore or reject the body, but rather to consider it in multiple ways in search of liberation. So in a way, the body could be an obstacle to liberation, but it could also be the vessel, the tool to it, right? Because the body also holds our mind, ability to meditate, to love, to serve. So it's a very important paper, and I feel that we're very fortunate to have this paper in the book.
Well, I had to do a bit of a double take when I saw when I first looked at the table of contents, because if I'm not mistaken, it was 2019 that Anemonius passed in. And so I was like, I thought to myself, this must be her final paper.
Yeah, it took very long for the book to be published as usual, right? With all the things and all that. Yeah, but yes, indeed. I remember I emailed with her virtually like a few weeks before her untimely death regarding her article and the volume and all that. And I had no idea, of course. And I wish I'd met her in person. Yeah, absolutely.
Paying homage to someone's past, and then 2 years later you see an article out in their name. It's great. It definitely was her last paper, and her legacy continues. It happens to be the case that she was my advisor's advisor, so her work has impacted me in many ways through my doctoral training and beyond.
Absolutely. I've known Anne for many years. Like, she was a colleague and a friend, and it's still a shock for me. And my sympathy goes out to her family, colleagues, friends, to us all. Everyone is affected, you know, and she was really loved and appreciated by all. And she was a wonderful person. Yeah.
Indeed. The third paper in the volume. Stefania
Cavalieri. studies the drama Vijñana Gita by Keshav Das, who is a 16th, 17th century author, in order to illustrate the multiple values attributed to the body. The author argues that in Vedantic perspective, the body is described in the dichotomy between the self and the world, and it represents the seat of illusions connected to the material creation. She holds that it can be used as a symbol of religious and moral rigor and as a key to political authority or as the abode of deprivation. And she also states that oleographic representations of the body of the heretics play a central function in iconological analysis, while in poetry, the limbs of the body are popular terms of comparison for literary descriptions. And she also examines the path of yogic control of the body that is indispensable for achieving the most unexpected transformations from the acquisition of a different gender to the attainment of final release or moksha. And I think she concludes that the drama Vijñana Gita reinterprets the relation body-mind in the process of liberation of the self in the light of new religious concepts of devotional inspirations, yoga practices, and secular requirements related to the socio-cultural context of the 17th century. So it's a very interesting paper, which is which also offers a deep, sustained textual analysis of the text. And I also found her point very interesting, that the combined theology of renunciation propagated by Buddhism and Jainism with the Sufi literary models of rulers who become ascetics to win victory over the body and attain the utmost reward of divine love. So she looks at Hinduism or Hindu tradition in contact also with the Buddhist, Jaina, and Sufi tradition. So this is also very interesting, you know, very innovative, very exciting.
Fascinating indeed. The next paper you're quite familiar with, you wrote it.
Yeah, exactly. The next paper refers to my study on the Radha Swami tradition. Like, I studied the notions of yoga and bhakti in the tradition of Radha Swami in the 19th and 20th century, which in a way transcends traditional Hinduism in multiple ways. And I analyze ritual practice, which involves elaborate meditations known as Sura Jap Yoga, or yoga of the sound of the inner current. And I focus on the role of the subtle body in meditation. And I examine the complex links between yoga, bhakti, and pilgrimage, and discussing both yogic meditational and devotional practices, like the practice of collective meditation during the satsang, which represents at the same time the manifestation of the devotee's guru bhakti, or devotion to the guru. And in the diaspora, a mental pilgrimage to the satsang in India, because when the devotees meditate in India, they see the image of the guru via an electronic transmission. So they travel, not their mind, the mind travels not only upward in terms of the tantric conventions, but also horizontally across the globe to be together with the community in India. So in order to study this, I have also examined elements of Radha Swami religiosity, which invite the devotee to long for a darshan of the guru and encourage followers to meditate on him. And I've also discussed the concept of arti in Radha Swami, which represents an internalization of ritual worship in which the devotee might offer to his guru the parts of his inner body. So this is a nirguna arti, the non-manifest. It's not the arti we know from the puja ritual of devotional Hinduism.
This episode is brought to you by Saks.com. At Saks.com, it's easy to find your new vibe. Dive into the Western trend with gold cowboy boots from Staud, or go full 90s throwback with platforms from Prada. You can shop for everything on your agenda, whether it's a breezy Zimmermann dress for a garden party or a bright Chloe blazer for brunch. Find inspiration for your new vibe every day at Saks.com.
So your research represents a real affirmation of the body, would you say?
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And I hope to show that this the body and the mind are not really opposed to each other. They're not like enemies, right? We use the mind. We use the body to work with our mind. So in Hinduism, I think this is what's fascinating, that there's not really a hostile relationship between the two. On the one hand, one needs to, if you look at asceticism, one needs to kind of subdue the body. But on the other hand, we also have so many other modern movements, and of course the Buddhist tradition, and that, where one follows such a path, if you want, of moderation, where one uses the body in order to work with the mind.
Would you say that, would you say that this attitude, that this inimical relationship between the mind and the body, or the self and the body, this view that the body might be the obstacle or the enemy in some sense, would you say that's an indigenous Indic view as well, or would you say that's a projection?
Absolutely. And if you allow me, I would like to maybe talk a little bit about what I'm discussing in the introduction, where I discuss this issue of the body-mind dichotomy, which is also known as Cartesian dualism. And I explain how the contributions of South Asian thought of Hinduism and Buddhism have helped also Western philosophy, Western thought, overcome this, like in the figure of Husserl and Maurice Merleau-Ponty, who have been influenced by Hindu thought, and how it helped them develop concepts in Western philosophy in order to overcome this dichotomy of the body in Western thought. Barbara Horridge has also explored such issues. But this concept of Merleau-Ponty of chiasm, etc., it's also related to the influence of Western thought, like Maurice Merleau-Ponty, which is the conclusion that you cannot be touched without being touched. You cannot touch someone without being touched by that person. And this also has to deal with the concept of Brahman and Atman, and how they are raised in Hinduism, where, I mean, you can read the introduction. I don't propose to kind of repeat it here, but you know how in a way Brahman becomes embodied in Atman, though, and also the concept of Ishvara, which also can be interpreted in this way. So in a way, yes, I do think that this is the contribution of Hindu and Buddhist thought, this a way of looking at the body and this offering ways to overcoming, you know, the dualism that Western philosophy had always struggled with.
Well, the insights that you share in the introduction are fair game, and precisely what is of interest in this type of conversation, insofar as it curates the material, it orients the reader, it brings out the broad themes of the fruits of the labor of the contributors. Speaking of which, what is in paper number 5? What's in the next paper?
Yeah, paper number 5, as I explained, like this is a book, you know, that offers a variety of approaches and variety of perspectives. So paper 5 or chapter number 5 is written by Nandi Bhatia, who examines Bhakti Siddhanta's novel Cracking India. The novel appeared in 1992. And the author observes that the novel has become the urtext text for critics who argue that this is how we can review religious discourse and cultural nationalism during partition, and that they were actually intertwined, and how the enemy was identified in corporeal terms. Bhatia argues that the representation of bodies, especially women's bodies, has also acquired a prominent place in critical analysis of literature about the 1947 partition of India. She reflects on the importance of foregrounding these brutalized bodies, especially women's bodies, in fiction, and asserts that their significance lies in bringing attention to the scale of violence that broke out and rapidly became genocidal. And the author states that by exposing this unprecedented gendered violence during the partition, literary texts make a feminist analysis possible, an analysis that links the violence on bodies to the intersecting interests of community in the state and nation. And the author concludes that in the absence of stories and testimonials of those who survived the violence, literary texts provide the horrific and forgotten stories of ordinary people. So she is right, I think, in observing that literature plays an extremely important role here, you know, to write the forgotten histories of all those victims, of people who suffered, of dispossessed, of the violated, etc. And we should not forget. Huh? And today actually is the day of Holocaust Day. We commemorate Holocaust, but, you know, violence and injustice has happened throughout the world in so many ways. And the partition of India and the violated bodies of women is one such instance. So I think I cannot even imagine how important, you know, basically Nandi Bhatia's contribution has been by taking up this topic and reminding us of the sufferings, you know, of people, the really material suffering, female bodies.
An important contribution, to be sure.
Yeah. So, okay.
What about the sixth paper?
Yeah, the sixth paper the sixth chapter is written by Matthew Bovert, who explores the Hijra community in Mumbai and Pune, and argues that Hijras, the third gender, are defined by a series of rituals that embody femininity and empower their status. Based on observation and interviews with 25 respondents from different gharanas, gharanas is where the household in which this Hijra live, the author discusses four rituals at the very core of the Hijra identity. For example, the rit, the ritual of entry within the Hijra community, the nirvan, the ritual of castration, the dudi pilana, the ceremony of milk feeding, and the tirtha yatra. This is the pilgrimage to specific sacred locations. He suggests looking at the first three rituals as samskara, or rites of passage, and holds that this analysis will allow us to understand not only their symbolic meaning, but also the shaping of the Hijra body that these rituals engender through their performance. And Bovert points out that these rituals not only give meaning, structure, and cohesion to the community, but also define the entire Hijra body socially and individually. So it's a very important paper that gives us an insight into a community that I would say has not been much studied. And by interviewing people, to come back to our initial conversation, it lets the community, you know, the people talk, utter their voices, and I consider this extremely important.
A question. And the final contribution, Gita Pai's When Humans Pose as Hindu Gods.
Mm-hmm. In chapter seven, Gita Pai discusses four case studies in the United States and in India in the period of 14 years, from 2002 to 2016. Which is centered on utilizing human figures in the guise of Hindu devas or gods in print media. And she reflects on the iconography of Shiva and then proceeds to examine two case studies that relate the reaction of Hindu advocacy to the representation of individuals as the dancing divinity in order to market a consumer product or promote a new story. She also looks into two case studies of Hindu organizations' response to magazine covers that showcase Vishnu in order to publicize the featured stories. So it's an interesting use of the body. The author studies what religious organizations reveal about themselves when they contest representation of human bodies as gods in the media, and reflects on their claim that using deities in this way promotes a negative image of Hinduism, as it constitutes a commercial misappropriation of the sacred iconography. And Gita Pai argues that religion becomes reified rather than dynamic, and that those who protest against this use of divine imagery expose more about their proclaimed rights rather than concerns over the actual preservation of religious purity. So it's a very exciting paper, which studies issues of modernity, which point to the use of religion in print media. And as we know, the print media has been extremely important, right? One talks about print capitalism and all these things that happen with in relation to nationalism. So now in the terms of post-nationalism or post-colonialism, the question is, yeah, this use of print media, what does it really say about, you know, the future of things? I don't think the author gives an answer, right? But these questions, I think, can be revisited in a few decades or few, just to see, you know, whether we continue make such use of religion or whether we just maybe grapple more secular topics. I don't know what print media's orientation will be. But for now, I think it's extremely topical, extremely interesting.
No question. Is this work that you're continuing, work on the body?
Well, this is a very interesting question. I've been actually thinking of revisiting the topic and focusing more on the othering of the body, because you have probably noticed that a group that is missing from this book, and I, as the editor, can say it, this is, for example, the Dalits. We talk about minority groups and how the body has been used to legitimate power, to marginalize. So in a way, this group has been intrinsically implied. But we have studies on that issue. And I am thinking that this would be very important, you know, to study also the body in terms of Muslim representation, Dalit representation, Sikhs, just to give really a true study, a glimpse of the use of the body, the interpretation, representation of the body in South Asian traditions. So the book, the present book has begun the dialogue, but I think we need to go beyond the book in order to really explore these issues in greater detail.
Well, certainly you'll be back on the podcast to discuss the next book whenever it's out. Is there anything else about the volume that you hope we would touch on?
Just would like to maybe say that there are multiple ways of looking at the body, and that the other contributions or studies on the body are extremely important. And I mentioned in the introduction also the works of Axel Michels, who is actually my Sanskrit professor from the University of Heidelberg, recently retired. The works of Barbara Horwich and Karen Pichilis, the works of George Patti, Zupko, of Kasulis, Ames and Tisanayaki, Walker and Cutler, White, Alter. So many people have written on the body, but I just want to say that it's such a fascinating topic, and I hope that our book would invite more scholars to engage with the body and to continue working on this important topic, because in a way, it is also who we are, right? Being, having a body and overcoming the body is what makes us in a way also human, right? So it's a topic that has great importance, and I hope it will generate further discussions, no matter whether we study yogic tradition, field work among the community. I think it's a fascinating topic. Explore it further.
It's fascinating indeed. I struck by the role of embodiment in the Devi Mahatmya. You may be aware I do Sanskrit narrative primarily, but in every encounter with the goddess, in every episode in the Devi Mahatmya, she always emerges from the body of other beings, and I believe that's very purposeful in encoding an ideology that's world affirming and affirming of the state of embodiment. But as I say, enough about me and my fetish with Indian myth. Thank you for appearing on the podcast today, Diana.
Thank you so much for having me. It was a pleasure talking to you. Thank you.
All right. For those of you listening, we've been speaking with Dr. Diana Dimitrova, you've been talking about this brand new 2021 publication, Rethinking the Body in South Asian Traditions. Until next time, stay safe, stay sane, keep listening, and keep contemplating the importance of being embodied. Take care.